I'm Mike Mason with a check of the local news on KDLG. A handful of residents who live along Squaw Creek Road in Dillingham are asking the city of Dillingham to take over the maintenance of the road, which has not been maintained by either the state or the city since last winter. Back in early January, the state of Alaska decided to stop maintaining Squaw Creek Road. The Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities found that the state has no property rights to the road, and they cited concerns about damaging maintenance equipment as a reason for the decision. At the time, the city of Dillingham declined to take possession of the road and to take over maintenance. As a result, Squaw Creek Road has fallen to a state of disrepair, and maintenance has been left to the residents who live along the road. Raybel Whitcomb lives along Squaw Creek Road, and she brought up the status of the road at last week's Dillingham City Council meeting. Whitcomb confirmed that she recently had to hire a private contractor to grade the road in order to provide access for a septic pumping truck. Whitcomb provided some information to the council that indicates that the residents along Squaw Creek Road pay upwards of $90,000 a year in taxes to the city of Dillingham. She contends that for that kind of money, the city should take over maintenance of the road.
I see a couple options. First, the city can actually start doing the maintenance of the road. I understand that there's issues with the easements on the beginning half of the road. Work with the property owners. There is certainly enough money collected on here to start doing some, at least some negotiations and start allocating some of the money for that.
Squaw Creek Road currently does not meet the road standards for the city of Dillingham, which makes it difficult for the city to take ownership. Additionally, the city can't take ownership of the road because the front and back portions of the road are privately owned by several different people, and there are no easements for public access on those parts of the road. Also, several landowners have refused to allow the clearing of brush and trees along the road that would allow maintenance equipment to transit the road. Whitcomb sounded exasperated during her presentation last week.
What are we going to do when it starts snowing? What are we going to do? Our kids keep walking. You know, it stopped Head Start bus service. It has stopped city school bus service. But yet the SPED bus keeps going down the road. We only want the basic services that everybody else gets. And I understand it's going to take some time. But you as council members, you guys can make the difference. You guys can say, let's maintain the road while we work this out. Why are you letting, you know, residents of Squaw Creek Road suffer for this?
The issues about ownership and lack of public access easements have apparently been known to the city and many of the landowners for years. But it wasn't until the state decided to stop maintaining the road that those issues started generating public concern. Annie Shade owns rental property along Squaw Creek Road.
I get that this is way complicated. It's always been that way. We tried to get a mortgage 20 years ago and couldn't because we don't have legal access. I'm okay with that. You know, we figured out another way to deal with it, but I'm not okay with not being able to get ambulance and fire equipment down there, you know, and septic trucks and stuff like that. You know, if I have one of my renters fall down and, you know, get hurt, and we can't get emergency equipment down, you know, that's a big deal. So if we can just figure out a way to just make it passable, because waiting for this is going to take forever. So, yeah, if we could just come up with a plan, I mean, even once a week or something, just to keep it clear, anything would really, really help.
Another of the Squaw Creek Road residents who turned out last week was Steve Shade. Last winter, he plowed the road using his own plow, and he cited the maintenance expenses he's incurred during his testimony to the city council.
If you guys aren't going to do no service for us, take us off your tax collection list. Don't charge us no more sales tax. Take us off all your property collections. So, and not only that, it's a health and safety issue. We can't get no fire insurance down there because, you know, we have no legal access. We can't get fire insurance on our homes because of that. And when the road is bad, somebody gets hurt down there, they're going to be dead before they get out. They'll be dead. So that road is very bad.
The city of Dillingham has been lobbying the State Department of Transportation and Public Facilities to reverse course and resume the maintenance of Squaw Creek Road, but that apparently won't happen until the access and ownership issues are resolved. That could take some time because some of the landowners have been unwilling to allow easements, which is even more complicated because some of the land comes in the form of native allotments. Dillingham Mayor Alice Ruby confirmed the city is looking for solutions to the issue, but she objects to the idea that residents could or should be excluded from paying taxes until the Squaw Creek Road issue is resolved.
There's a lot more in the city besides road plowing. There's schools, there's library, there's police, there's fire, there's dock and harbor, and so it isn't really fair to say that we shouldn't pay taxes because we don't get a road plowed. There's an awful lot more that we provide. If that were the case, then maybe I shouldn't pay taxes at all because I don't live on a city street. And I don't feel that way. I do feel like we all contribute for the good of the community, the good of everyone.
Squaw Creek Road is only about 6/10 of a mile long, but there are nearly 40 homes along the road and one large apartment complex. Nothing was settled at last week's council meeting, and until the situation changes, neither the City of Dillingham nor the State Department of Transportation plans on taking over maintenance of the road. With the general election less than a month away, national pollsters are watching for signs Democrats are going to hang on to their majority in the United States Senate. In Alaska, incumbent Senator Mark Begich, a Democrat, is facing challenger Dan Sullivan, a Republican. As KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports, one local expert who's paying close attention to the race says the two campaigns are using different strategies to put their candidate in the lead.
Wood Journalism Chair Mark Trahant at the University of Alaska Anchorage says the Alaska Senate race is important because whoever is elected will have a role in determining how the nation handles critical issues such as climate change and health care. He says it's also an interesting race to watch as a test of campaign strategies.
Nationally and in here in Alaska, Democrats and Republicans have basically put together very different strategies. The Republicans are spending and their allies are spending enormous amounts of money on television, television ads, traditional fire-up-the-base type, really deep ads that get people's blood boiling.
Trahant says Democrats have put more of their money into field offices, staff, and research to support person-to-person conversations and to build get-out-the-vote operations.
So it'll be interesting to see come Election Day which of those strategies pays off.
Trahant says Democrats are following a playbook from elections where data analysis and strategic communications helped put President Obama in the White House after trailing in the polls.
What really changed the race was this unbelievable turnout operation where they went through and built computer models based on where people are and what they needed from that community and then started putting up charts saying, how do we get to X number of votes?
The Dan Sullivan for U.S. Senate campaign has its four offices located in Alaska's population centers in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Wasilla, and Juneau. And Sullivan campaign co-chair Tara Sweeney says they also have a number of volunteers reaching out to rural Alaska.
We have contacts in rural Alaska that we are working with to deploy our ground game. I can't give you the specifics because I do not want to necessarily tip our hand in terms of the tactics and the strategy, but what I can tell you is we have a ground game in rural Alaska. We've got contacts out there that we're working with to ensure that Dan Sullivan is elected to the United States Senate.
The Alaskans for Begich campaign has a total of 16 offices in Alaska, some in the larger communities, other in regional hubs such as Barrow and Nome, and a handful in small towns such as Kodiak and Kenai. Max Crows, director of communications for the Begich campaign, says staff and volunteers are working to get people engaged.
Senator Begich believes that at the end of the day, Alaskans are going to make their decision based on who best knows Alaska's issues and who represents their issues. In rural Alaska in particular and specifically, the Alaska Democratic Party and Senator Begich have been very aggressive about establishing a presence and making sure that each community has the ability to have conversations with one another.
So who's ahead? Trahant says with Alaska's small population, a few responses can skew poll results by several points. Since mid-September, Begich and Sullivan have been apart by a few points in the polls, with one then the other taking the lead. Now, using the average of the three latest polls, Real Clear Politics puts Sullivan ahead by 6 points. At the same time, Real Clear Politics calls Alaska polls fickle and untrustworthy, a view Trahant shares.
It's really hard to poll Alaska, and you just don't have a large enough group of people to interview to get a really useful sample size. So it's really a shot in the dark in that sense.
6 years ago, Begich only narrowly beat former Republican Senator Ted Stevens, who had been charged with corruption just a week before the election. Otherwise, Alaska has not elected a Democrat to the U.S. Senate since 1974. On the other hand, the State Division of Elections is allowing absentee in-person voting at some 130 new sites, most in rural Alaska. Democrats hope voters at the new absentee polling places will trend in their direction. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
The city of Dillingham is exploring the possibility of stopping the practice of adding fluoride to the city drinking water. Adding fluoride to drinking water is a common practice for municipal water systems across the country. However, it's not that common here in the Bristol Bay region. The city of Dillingham does add fluoride, but the practice could be about to stop. Dillingham City Manager Rose Louetta made the suggestion during last week's City Council meeting.
We're required, are now required by DEC to install two flow switches. The flow switches are to prevent any fluoride from being injected when no water is flowing or in the event of one of the switches failing. That process to install those flow switches could contaminate our water lines. And if it contaminated the water lines, there's a possibility of us having to drain the water tanks, the two big water tanks that we have, in order to disinfect it. DEC does not have a requirement for communities to fluoride their water at all. We're the only community in Bristol Bay to do that.
Besides the city of Dillingham, the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation adds fluoride to its water system that serves the Kanakanak Hospital compound in Dillingham. Louetta stressed that only a small portion of the Dillingham population actually gets fluoride in their drinking water.
As you know, our water system is only downtown here. It's not out in the outside of the downtown Dillingham, so the majority of the people are off of are operating on private wells. We do get fluoride from a number of different sources, from brushing your teeth, from things you drink and eat, and from the dentist.
The Dillingham City Council was unwilling to just arbitrarily stop adding fluoride to the municipal water system. Instead, the idea has been referred to the city's Finance and Budget Committee, which will be tasked with making a formal recommendation about the matter to the City Council. The cost of fluoride to the city is about $2,000 a year. With some major stores finding their customers' accounts being compromised, celebrities' personal cloud accounts being hacked, and bank accounts being spied on, internet security has never been more important. October is National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and KDLG's Thea Card filed this report to explain how to keep your information safe online.
According to the Internet Crime Complaint Center, consumers lost $780 million last year to internet crime, up 50% from 2012. This year, the Better Business Bureau is partnering with Stop Think Connect to help individuals feel secure online. Both organizations encourage online users to take extra security measures this month. Alaska Regional Manager for BBB, Michelle Tabler, says having secure accounts with store credit cards is important.
And it's really frustrating because some of the these data breaches were people actually going into stores and using their credit cards in this situation, and then these big retailers were hacked, like the Target and Home Depot and those, and their systems were hacked. What's really important for people to remember is check your credit card statement every single month. Check your bank statement and check your cell phone statement every month to make sure that all of the purchases on there are legitimate and that you actually did them. So it's important to save receipts.
Tabler says there are precautions one can take to protect against cybercrime: keeping your personal computer virus-free and up-to-date, protecting personal information, and connecting with care are just some of the measures you can take.
You want to have long, strong, and unique passwords. And I know that means having these types of passwords for each different account. Just keep track of them somewhere off of your computer. Do not keep that sort of thing on your computer, because if a hacker gets into it, they can open the file that has all your passwords on it. So you want to be really careful of that.
If you receive an email from your bank or any other business that you have an account with claiming that there's an issue, don't click on the link they send. Always go to the site on your own. Tabler says the links could be a virus or a fake website. She says hackers are able to forge logos and symbols of banks and businesses easily.
Click over the URL, see where it's actually coming from. but just be careful. And if you have any real questions about what it's telling you, call the number that's on the back of your card. Call the number that you have for your bank. Do not call the number or click on anything in that email.
Stop, Think, Connect is an online awareness campaign hoping to help all people on the Internet stay safe and secure. For more information on Cybersecurity Month, look for the BBB on Facebook. In Dillingham, I'm Thea Card.
A group of Bethel residents held a protest against bootlegging and drug dealing this past Friday, a day after the first permanent fund dividends were distributed. Organizers say they chose PFD Day because it's a time when illegal drug and alcohol sales go up. KYUK's Charles Enoch went to the protest and filed this report.
A north wind buffets protesters with sand and dust, but that doesn't stop the group from getting out their message. A sign reads, "Please feed your kids, not addictions." Just before the 5 p.m. rush hour, a group of about two dozen Bethel residents are gathering at the three-way stop known as Watson's Corner in downtown Bethel. Mohammed Ziauddin was one of those protesting. He used to work at an alcohol treatment center and remembers seeing the devastating impacts of addiction.
I have seen a very severe devastation of the effects of alcohol and drugs based on my previous job experience. I had been directly in the homes of families, and I've seen firsthand parents being passed out on the floor, kids crying with no food to eat, and very unhealthy hygienic conditions and neglect, all that stemming from alcohol and drug abuse.
Horns honk in support for the protest at Bethel's busiest intersection, and the line of traffic grows longer as people get off work. The group, Bethel Direct Action Against Drugs and Alcohol, organized the protest. In 2009, Bethel voters decided 615 to 523 to change Bethel from a damp community to a wet one. Voters opted to remove the local option, prohibiting alcohol sales in Bethel, and removing the previous importation limit of 10.5 ounces of alcohol per person per month. However, the city has never approved a license allowing the sale of alcohol. Bootlegging has long been a problem in the Southwest Alaska Hub community of between 6 and 7,000, but the group says it's gotten way worse since the alcohol import limit was removed. This past February, there was a black tar heroin bust, and protesters say that hard drugs are also causing problems. Julian Jacobs of Bethel formed the group leading the protest. He says he hopes it will raise awareness about the not-so-subtle toll that illegal alcohol and drugs are taking on the community.
This is a very out loud thing that people see. They could smell it everywhere in the stores. They could see it everywhere in the stores. You know, no matter what time of the day it is in BNC or wherever, and it's time to stop ignoring that problem.
Jacob says the group is working with tribal organizations and state and federal officials to take suppliers out of the equation. The next meeting of the Bethel Direct Action Against Drugs and Alcohol group is scheduled for Saturday, October 11th at 5:30 p.m. at the log cabin near the ONC Multipurpose Building. The meeting is open to the public and will include input from Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell, the Western Alaska Alcohol and Narcotics Team, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Drug Enforcement Administration. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
Kuskokwim area commercial salmon fishermen earned $2.2 million in 2014. A preliminary report from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game released last Friday shows total income slightly below last year's total, but still 27% above the 10-year average. Fishermen in District 1, the lower Kuskokwim, tallied $818,000, while Quinnahock fishermen earned $844,000. Good News Bay fishermen were paid $576,000. Region-wide, the 1.5 million pounds of coho salmon brought the most cash for fishermen, prices just under a dollar a pound. That total was more than double the 10-year average. Commercial fishing was delayed on the Kuskokwim until most of the chum and sockeye had traveled upriver. That was due to subsistence needs after long king salmon restrictions. And the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium will receive $1.1 million for efforts aimed at preventing heart disease, diabetes, and strokes. The initiative is among those being funded nationwide with nearly $212 million from the federal government. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services says the grant funding is aimed at combating chronic health problems. Goals include reducing the rates of death and disability due to tobacco use, heart disease, stroke, or diabetes, as well as reducing obesity. Other health organizations and communities in Alaska will receive about $540,000 in grants to focus on populations hit hardest by chronic diseases. Many of the stories you hear during the KDLG local news can be found online at kdlg.org. You can also find contact information on that website if you would like to provide a comment, a correction, or a news tip. That's a check of the local news on listener-supported public radio KDLG. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason, reporting.